Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Vicki, and myself will sit down with UK Extension Wheat Specialist Dr. Travis Leglider to discuss weed control options for 2022 and I think just the spring season in general. So, and as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Vicki, how about you? I'm
doing better. I'm upright and walking.
You getting around good?
I'm getting around good.
Vicki missed last week's show with us due to a technical error, I guess you could say. We'll call it that.
glad for right now
you don't have to have surgery. So.
Yes, I am too.
So. And David's going to be with us during this show, but next week he's going to be out, and Vicki and I will be doing one on our own. So,
well, at least it's dry right now. At least it's not raining right now. You know, hopefully we're going to be a day or two here, but I think it's coming in. We're taping this show, but I think it's still coming in again. But, you know, it's been tough this spring trying to get anything done.
You know, we're recording this show the week after Easter in 2022, and we actually had a rain creep in on Easter and then Easter Sunday night that I wasn't really expecting. So,
the old wives' tale, and I've been listening about this, you know, and they said if it rains on Easter, it's supposed to rain the next 5 Sundays, I think. I'd never heard that. That's the first time I'd ever heard that particular wives' tale. But, you know, I don't know which winter we're in the middle of right now, if it's linen breeches or blackberry or whatever. But, I mean, we're in the middle of something because it's cold as all get out this morning.
If I had to guess right now, we're in dogwood winter.
Yeah.
Dogwoods are blooming later. We always, you know, the old adage is that dogwoods will bloom by Easter. Yeah. And we didn't have any dogwoods blooming until the very end of last week. But Thursday or Friday, I saw my first one. So
yeah, that must be what it is because it's pretty nippy this morning.
We'll still have blackberry winter and
linen britches
winter and all that still to go. So,
well, the good part about spring, though, this time of year, it does tend to dry up a little faster because there's a lot of wind. Mm-hmm. We're getting a lot of wind. I mean, yesterday was pretty windy, and so, you know, that helps in our the cold weather doesn't last as long. It's, you know, I think it's supposed to be up near the 80s maybe this weekend. So
I noticed a little bit of worked ground Sunday afternoon, actually, that was starting to dry on top from some of that wind you're talking about. And then we got another shower that night.
I mean, you know, how we could stand about at least a week of dry weather to get rolling. I mean, we're not even – there has been some corn planted different places. There in McLean County there's been some, and then there's been some in Christian County I know of because I actually saw the planter running.
Right.
But, you know, it's not very much, and folks are pretty – they were probably antsy at the beginning of April, and they're really antsy right now. So
yeah, I'm not even seeing much equipment moving down the road right now in Webster County yet. So
A few more dry days would be nice. It doesn't really need to be that warm, but if we had some sunshine and some wind to go along with it, that'd go a long way. So
absolutely.
Except for our topic today, wind and spring does not go together.
That's exactly right. So that's a good segue, Vicki. We'll just roll right there and welcome Dr. Travis Leglider. He's our UK Extension Wheat Control Specialist. Travis, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on today.
Good. We're glad to have you on. This has kindly been a regular thing to have a UK Extension Specialist with us, not every week, but a lot of the weeks. And the insight that you all give and technical advice that you give, especially to farmers throughout the season, and the assistance you give agents is invaluable. We certainly appreciate it and glad you're here with us this morning.
Yeah.
So we're, I don't know, if David, you have anything you want to kick it off with? Or?
well, you know, this spring has been just crazy, Travis. And, you know, there has been, as you travel around, there's been several fields that have sprayed burned down. However, there are those fields that have not been sprayed, and actually there's a field beside my house. It's the volunteer wheat's about 10 or 12 inches high. What in the world are we going to do, you know, with thinking about availabilities of herbicides and different things? What are we going to do with some of those type things that we're starting to get some size on it because we can't get in the field?
Right. So I think that's a big problem. And I think there's also some instances where some of those burn downs have been put on maybe didn't do as well as we had hoped they'd done either. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to also cover those. So with those, we're just going to have to really think through our rate structure of what we're going to use. And, you know, I know the big shortage right now is glyphosate. And so a lot of guys were thinking about, you know, do I need that in my burn down or not? Or can I hold on to that till later? As, you know, some of these weeds get bigger and bigger, that, you know, makes us say, well, maybe we do need that glyphosate in our burn down. And that's unfortunate because I think a lot of guys had a good plan for doing a burn down without the glyphosate and then saving that for their post. But unfortunately, the spring has not cooperated at all. And wind would be nice to dry things out, but then also, yeah, it's not good for spraying either. Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing that's been happening is it's still cold. I mean, I ran out to the station this morning and looked at our temporary weather station we have out, and I think we got down to 30 at about 5:25 this morning. So, mm-hmm. I mean, those are not good conditions for spraying burn downs. I mean, and I think there's going to be some instances where guys have sprayed because they had a window of dry weather, but it may not be a complete burn down that they wanted.
I think that's a really good point, you know, and this has always been the case, but more so now than ever. Most of the different chemistries that we work with are designed to do a specific job during a specific range of conditions, and some of those conditions have a lot to do with the temperature, the growth stage of the weed that they're being applied to. And all of that, none of that has followed the script this year. It's just been all over the place because we've had weed growth that seemed like it started early and just kind of prolonged and lagged along. A lot of places may not have had some of the weed emergence when they hit that dry weather to do some of that spraying. And I think that's what I've seen a lot in my county especially is ground may have been sprayed earlier, but it's been long enough now that you're starting to see some regrowth. And
Yep, exactly. This spring, you know, I had an article about ryegrass. I put this Venn diagram together, but I think it can apply to all burn downs. But it's basically, you know, you have the right temperatures, you have the right growth stage, but you also have the fields dry enough that you can get a sprayer over. And you have to have all three of those. I don't think we've probably not had all three. Yeah, I don't think we've ever had all three at the same time.
No.
Yeah, at the same time. And that's the ideal condition for all burn downs, and we just haven't had it. So, you know, we had some dry spells there in the middle of March, and guys could get across the fields, and the weeds were the right size. But, man, it's every couple of days we're dipping down below freezing, it seems like, or we're under a frost advisory. And that's not good for burn downs. Even the best burn down, you know, the weeds are growing, but when it's getting that cold at night, it's really working against your chemistry.
And that's really part of the issue there is you don't have that actively growing weed at the time of application. It's at a different stage than it needs to be for the chemistry really to do its job.
Yeah. So that weed, it's growing, but it's not growing fast enough, but it's still growing, so it's still getting big. So it's kind of this, it's a terrible thing to have because the weeds are growing, but they're not growing fast enough, and we're not getting the temperatures for our chemistries to really do a good job the way we expect them to do. So that's the problem. And Jay, as you alluded to, the other problem is I've seen, you know, and just driving around, some of these burn downs, guys did a really good job and it worked really well, but they haven't been able to. You know, their intention was probably to have them planted the corn by now, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely.
There's other weeds starting to emerge now, and they're going to have to do another burn down, and that's going to be terrible in a year where they probably don't have another burn down in their pocket to spray.
Well, and when you know, made a point there about trying to make that decision on do we use glyphosate as a burn down that we really wasn't hoping to do because you want to keep that in your pocket for the post-application, but when we're looking at this situation, though, you know, producers really need to look at that and see, because if the weeds are going to be, if you're not going to be able to control those without glyphosate, you do have, hopefully, you know, you've got some other options to come in there with a post application and make that post application with other products. But that's going to take some planning.
Yeah.
And that's going to take some thought into knowing if you're going to have to change when you're going to use that product. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to have some plans in place for what you're going to do post if that glyphosate's not there.
Yeah.
Let's back up a little bit too, Travis. What if you can't say you're a producer out here and you can't get glyphosate? You know, because there are some, or the glyphosate is so expensive you know, maybe what are some other options maybe that they could possibly think about using for a burn down if that's not available?
Yeah, so one of the first things we go to if we're not going to have glyphosate available is potentially using paraquat or gramoxone. So, and that's something that, you know, it has its issues too, right? So,
and they have to have that certification.
Yeah, you have to have your certification to be able to buy it, to be able to spray it, and then you still have to be very careful with it. And the other thing with that is you have to put it on the right spray volume, so it's a contact herbicide, right?
Yeah.
And you're talking big weeds, and you know,
more volume.
Yeah, you need to have at least 20 gallons per acre,
right,
to really make that work, and you know, really up that rate of gramoxone. And you know, a lot of times we really encourage guys to also mix in, you know, depending on if you're in corn or soybeans, either metribuzin or atrazine, because you know, not to get too deep into this, but both of those, both gramoxone and those PS2 inhibitors, which would be atrazine and metribuzin, they both work on the photosynthetic pathway on two different ends of it. So when you put them together, they're a really good combination. So that's usually what we tell guys to do. So that's one thing you can do. As we get warmer, get some warmer conditions here. So if it just turns off and starts to get nice and warm and humid, you know, we could go to some glufosinate products, things like Liberty, but that's also short. So, but you could use that, you know, we definitely shouldn't have been using it up to this point in time, because, that's a herbicide that needs heat. It needs heat,
right,
and humidity, and it works great if it has that, but you have to have the right conditions. So, those are kind of the ones we look at, to really as alternatives. So there's not a lot of great alternatives, but
right,
but they are there. So,
and looking at those, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
And looking at those alternatives too, looking at maybe some weed control that Liberty may have some weaknesses that glyphosate may not have, and being aware of what those weaknesses are, I mean, may be something that they need to think about too.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So with Liberty, it doesn't do well in grasses. So
right,
if you've like got a lot of grass weeds, you know, I try to get your hands on some glyphosate if you can. So the other thing with your grass weeds, you can use some of the group ones. And I've heard about guys using some group ones. So that'd be something like clethodim, like Select, or Quizalofop, which is what's in Assure. And there's a whole range of them out there. But those are also herbicides that need heat. So I've heard reports that there's guys that were applying the group ones in March, and they're like, you know, I got an email from a guy saying, you know, hey, when should I expect to see activity out of this? And I said, when did you spray it? And this was at the end of March. And he said, 7 days ago. I said, I don't know if you're going to see activity out of this. Because, you know, you spray those products in the heat of the summer, and it takes a week to see anything happen.
Right.
Right.
You do it in a spring like this spring. So, and I know guys were going to that because they were trying to save their glyphosate, but it, Mother Nature did not cooperate with this herbicide shortage,
right,
unfortunately, and some of these backup products just don't work really well.
So, you really do need to know and understand what you're spraying, because if you don't, you may be spraying something like has sprayed something in early March that's not going to work because you don't have the heat.
Yeah.
And those type things. So,
yep.
Good point. I did talk to somebody the other day in the Litchfield area that actually is working their ground, has not worked ground in a long time. Because of the availability of some different products, they are actually working ground before they plant. So,
yep, that's the other option. So I always say tillage is a weed control option. Sometimes I get kicked out of rooms for saying that.
I think it's a reality now,
yeah,
though.
But
I think it is.
Well, and it's being discussed.
Yeah.
It's something that we can't ignore, because farmers are thinking about that, and for a very legitimate reason they're talking about that.
Right,
yeah,
right.
We're not too many generations away from when tillage was the weed control option.
Yep.
Yeah.
And where I think a lot of people have problems with that now is not just getting past that ideology, but they don't have the equipment to do it. They're either so far no-till or minimum till that they lack the deep tillage equipment to be able to do some of these things this time of the year.
Yeah, yep, that's the other problem. And the other thing is, if you haven't tilled in a long time, it's going back to remembering, you know, you can do a lot of damage if you till too wet.
Right.
You can do many years of damage. You know, you can reverse a lot of years of no-till, you know, some good things just by one pass of tillage at the wrong time. So, but yes, I think that's a great point that, yeah.
And knowing knowing where it's acceptable as far as tillage, because you can get into soil erosion issues in a hurry if we're not careful.
And we're working some ground now, or farming some ground now, that in the past was probably in cattle.
Right.
And so we've got to be really careful if we're going to talk about working that ground. The guy's farm I was actually on, he was putting new shovels on a field cultivator, a 30-foot field cultivator, and I hadn't seen new shovels in a long time.
Find those on eBay?
That's what I was thinking, you know. So I thought it was pretty interesting he was talking about working ground, because he said, I just can't get to glyphosate, you know, and he said, this is, to me, is my next best option.
So, I think that's a reminder for all of us, and we've talked about this before, Travis, the ease of use of glyphosate has kind of spoiled producers, in the sense that they always had that on to fall back on to clean up an issue. And now I think we're going to see some of those producers who, I don't want to say excel through some of these issues, but maybe aren't held back through some of these issues, are going to be the ones who have good working relationships with their agronomists, who are on top of things and know all the different options out there and can lay out a pretty good playbook for people to go
and
by.
Know their fields, know what weed pressures Absolutely. They have. I mean, I think that's huge. Knowing what weed pressures you have in certain fields, and then build your plan around that. Because if you don't know what weed you've got, I mean, putting a chemical plan together is going to be pretty tough.
You know, we've talked about scouting fields before being the basis for an IPM program, but really, it's going to be the basis for every decision made as far as weed control goes this year.
And we say it all the time. You got to know what weeds you're dealing with. And that's, you know, if I have somebody to call me or email me or, you know, text me, whatever, and say, hey, what weed control, you know, what program do you recommend? I say, what weeds do you have? Because I can't make any recommendations until I know what weeds you have. So, yeah, and you're exactly right. With glyphosate, it spoiled a lot of us, because it took care of everything.
Yeah.
You know, and then we got to the point of, okay, we have some glyphosate-resistant weeds, so we got to think about what we need for them. But we still had glyphosate in the tank taking care of everything else. But now it's going back and just, yeah, really thinking about those things. And, you know, we're going back 2 decades.
That's right. And we've talked about that multiple times on this podcast.
What were you spraying back in the mid-90s?
Yeah.
To be able to combat some of the
Roundup Ready was a new technology.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Right.
And I mean, even the cost. I mean, the cost of Roundup now is back closer to what it was
back then
mm-hmm. than it has been in more recent years.
Yep.
You know, because of the shortage and, mm-hmm. you know.
Yep. So, yep, those are all things. Yeah, it's going back to a lot of old chemistries that we haven't used a lot of. They're still around. They're still very viable, but going back to some of those chemistries.
Travis, talk to us a little bit about, I know we have a publication, university has a publication, Weed Control. You know, talk with us a little bit about how to define that, to get that, you know, because if you're going to have to jump back into some of those older chemistries, we have that information for folks.
Yeah, so it's AGR6, so it's the Weed Control Guide, but AGR6 is the publication number, and so it's got... we update it every single year. Every fall we update it, and so it has all of your herbicides that are available in corn, sorghum, soybean, and small grain. So mostly wheat, but we do include some of the other small grains in there. And with that, you have each product, and we just try to highlight what each product does and some of the restrictions on those products, or how to apply them and the rates to apply them. But also we have in there efficacy tables. So they're just tables with all the common weeds we have in Kentucky. We don't get every single one of them, but the common weeds, and basically our ratings on how well each of those herbicides works on those weeds. So
that to me, as a young agent, you know, going back almost 30 years ago, was one of the best parts of that book.
Yep.
Is being able to look at chemicals, as you know, when I was brand new, fresh out of school, a lot of them I was familiar with, but a lot of them I wasn't. When we have these new chemicals that come out, all that is a result of the trial work that you all do, and having that efficacy rating is a really, really good part of that book, I think.
Yeah. So, and that goes a long way. So, and there's lots of other little pieces of information packed into that book. So, I think some of the extension offices will have those on hand that you guys can go to the extension office and grab those.
I think most of most of the Kentucky ones, you know, ours, we try we have, to, yeah, yeah, most of us have those.
Yeah, so I'd say that's probably the first place to go if you want a hard copy, but you can also go online, you know, Google AGR 6 University of Kentucky, and you'll find the soft copy there. So,
And they'll print you a copy. You know, that's a good thing about any extension office you go to in Kentucky, they'll print you a copy. So if they don't
have one. There was a rolled up copy of AGR 6 on every truck dash that you worked with, but that's not the case anymore. Now it's on their phone for a lot of them. You can download that PDF version and have it handily accessible.
But, you know, I think folks are going to start relying on that more.
Oh, I do too.
Especially as we go on throughout the season and some of these products start to be hard to find, start to be hard to get, you know, and figuring out, hey, I've got this weed and I need, you know, I don't necessarily need Roundup. I need something else, you know. So,
I think in that book, too, it talks about some tank mixing and what can be tank mixed. And that's a key part, too, because when you start putting, you know, a spray program together and using different products to control different weeds. I mean, you know, Travis, you've done tremendous work on tank mixing, not just the products, but how to mix them and the order that you need to mix those products for them to work correctly. And, you know, a lot of that information can also be found in that AGR 6 too.
Yes, that information can be found there. So for each herbicide it's usually at the bottom of the description, but we have what can be tank mixed with it. But more importantly, on some of those, if there's things not to tank mix with, we have that do not tank mix with this.
And the additives too, needed with certain
surfactants.
Products.
That's what I was thinking of. Sure.
Yeah, because that's a big, surfactants, you know, if you want your herbicides to work well, I mean, it's not only, you know, getting to the weeds at the right time and the right size and the right weather, but also having the correct surfactant package in there with it as well. So all those little things that we didn't necessarily ignore with glyphosate, but maybe just didn't pay as much attention to.
Wasn't as critical.
We have to pay attention to it now. So
That's exactly right.
Travis has got a really good video on the internet that Coffee with Cats. Mm-hmm. And I actually show this at my pesticide trainings about tank mixing. And I think it's a very good, you know, the order that you put in chemicals has a lot to do with how that chemical reacts in the tank, you know. And, you know, way back when we used to have stopped up nozzles with atrazine and different things of this nature, part of that was we did not understand how to do some tank mixing. And you
the
know,
order of application,
right? The order of mixing and that type of thing.
Agitation.
So I mean, it's a really good video, and I do try to show that for folks.
I do too. It is an excellent one.
Yeah. So folks need to be aware of that when they're with these different chemicals that we're using that they're maybe not familiar with as much. You know, we need to think about that order of mixing and those type of things. So
I tell you what, too. Another thing on talking about the application and mixing. Travis, talk to us a little bit about the importance of that boom height.
Oh, yeah.
And where that boom height needs to be, and, you know, just talk about that
then
for
we'll
a minute.
Then we'll go to tip selection.
Yeah, no problem. So, yeah, no, boom height is important, and it's one, Vicki, I'm glad you brought it up, because it's one we don't talk about a lot, but we need to talk about a lot more. So your boom height should be 18 to 24 inches off the target. So target, that's the key word. That's where it needs to be. So 18 to 24 inches when you've got, you know, a 90, 120-foot boom, that looks pretty close to the ground from the cab of the sprayer.
It does.
Really does.
It is really close to the ground.
Yeah. And it looks scary. So, but, you know, there's a couple things there. So the way nozzles are designed, and I'm using my hands like you can see this, but the way they're designed is they're supposed to overlap, right? They're supposed to overlap. It's about 20 to 30%. That's because they're tapered on the edges. So if you have the boom higher than the 8, and they're designed to overlap that much at 18 to 24 inches based on, you know, a typical 20-inch or 30-inch spacing on your boom. So if your boom's higher than that, that overlap, you're overlapping. I see some of these booms so far up in the air, they're overlapping over 100%. And that's you're not getting your application on correctly. But then the other thing is if that boom is above that height, you know, if it's 3-4 foot in the air, that droplet takes that much longer to find its target. And when it takes that much longer to find its target, just one little wind gust is going to take that.
It finds another target.
Yeah. So
yeah, the spray pattern is not going to be what you want it to be.
Yeah. So you're, you know, not only are you going to have to deal with, you know, potentially deal with your neighbor and dealing with, injury to his crop or her crop, but also you paid good money for that product to not get it on your field.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about, and I know you and I visited last summer about, you know, we had a tremendous amount of dicamba damage in our area, and part of this was because of application problems that they mistakes that they made. So yeah, talk a little bit about maybe about that.
Yeah, so yeah, we saw a lot of in your area, just in that entire region, we saw a lot of dicamba injury last year. And you know, I still haven't been able to pinpoint one exact parameter that caused it. I think it's a combination of a lot of things. But yeah, you know, boom height's one of those things, making sure we have the right nozzles. But a big thing with dicamba is, you know, a lot of that injury was to soybean, right? To sensitive soybean, non-dicamba soybean. And part of the thing is soybean is extremely sensitive to dicamba. It's probably one of the most sensitive plants we have in the state of Kentucky to dicamba. So if that dicamba moved at all, the first plant that's going to show it is going to be a soybean field that's not resistant to dicamba. So, so it's either, you know, I think we're having issues with it moving at the time of application. So whether it's boom height, spring when it's too windy, not using the right nozzles. But the other thing is, you know, I think we're still having issues with this stuff moving around on us afterwards as well. You know, whether it's volatility or if we spray it into a temperature inversion, which is a whole nother discussion, right? Something yes. Something we hadn't paid attention to, you know, and this is not to take anything away from my weed science professor when I was an undergrad, but my undergrad class, we, you know, spent maybe 5 minutes on temperature inversions and just kind of went over it and went on with life.
Right? Because it wasn't an issue with most of the products that we were using.
Products, that's right.
Yeah.
That's
or right. any of them, yeah. So particularly.
I think we all had to go back and really learn about temperature inversions, and we're still learning a lot about them and how often they're actually occurring, with, you know, almost nightly in the summer.
I think there's a lot more occurrence than we think there is or have thought in the past that there was. So,
you know,
sure.
I'm sitting across the table listening to this, and I'm really thinking, David, we get a little bit closer to bean time, we probably need to sit down with Travis again and just have a talk about dicamba. If we were going to really give temperature inversion the time that it needed, I think we could sit not to steer away from it today, but I think it's one of those things that a little closer to time we probably need to sit down and do a whole nother show on.
Well, and you know, as far as off target movement too, a lot of it is, like, especially with dicamba, there's a lot of caveats that go into that. But even on other products, sometimes it's just looking around and seeing what's around you.
Absolutely.
And I think that especially in a spring like this, okay, we've talked about all this entire show, we've talked about how horrible of a spring. It's been cool. It's been wet. We can't get in the field. The weeds are too big. We don't have any corn planted. We've got a little bit of nitrogen down. We don't have near enough nitrogen down. We don't have fertilizer spread. And we could go on and on and on. When this weather breaks, it's going to be Katie bar the door. And I mean, and I think we get in a hurry and we don't stop to look around at our surroundings and see what is on the other side of us. And I think that is really important, because I think some of these off-target movements sometimes might be able to be curbed a little bit. Yeah, it could be curbed a little bit because of just taking a moment to look around and see what's on the other side of you.
Yeah.
You know, but we all get in a hurry, and especially in a year like this.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's for all products. So just not dicamba. Mm-hmm. I see every spring, even in a good spring with good conditions, I get samples at the diagnostic lab from 240 drifting in the spring. So, you know, 240, every product drifts, you know, 240 drifts. Another product that we use a lot of in burn downs is Sharpen, or the saflufenacil based products. And I know that drift pattern very well. It's very distinct. It's little brown spots. Mm-hmm. If you drift Sharpen, you know it, and I know it, and everybody's going to be able to see it. And I see it every single spring, and I agree. If this weather breaks and the wind's blowing, we got to be careful. I understand we got to be going and getting things done. I mean, I'm trying to do it on my own research plots. I was supposed to have a soybean planting in April, which it's not in. It's not in. Yeah. And so what? You know, I'm in the same boat of just, you know, really pulling my hair out, going, looking at the weather and just going, man, when is this going to break? But yeah, when it does, we're gonna have to be careful, because I think it's not just dicamba, but all these products drift. And if you're spraying when it's windy, it's going to show up. Yeah.
And there's a whole lot of high tunnels around that didn't used to be around. And, mm-hmm. You know, just a few years ago, you know, you didn't have those. But now you look around, there's a lot of high tunnels. And that can be costly.
Yep. You know, you mentioned 2,4-D and a spring burn down. That's not an issue a lot of places when you get that off-target drip. Typically, that's early enough in the year. You don't have a lot of other species out there, intentional species out there, that it's going to affect. The county where I spent the biggest part of my extension career, Christian County, we had a lot of commercial vegetable production, even before the advent of high tunnels, but especially with the advent of high tunnels. I dealt with a tremendous amount of 2,4-D injury every year in March, and that's exactly where it was. It was in those horticultural crops. Mm-hmm. It was in strawberries. It was in greenhouse tomatoes or high tunnel tomatoes. And it's an issue. It's more of an issue than we think it is, depending on your location.
Yeah, yeah, and tomatoes.
Yes.
Just a little bit. It does not take much 2,4-D. The tomato, you know, I talked about soybean sensitivity to dicamba. Tomatoes, they're the most sensitive thing we have to 2,4-D. It does, I mean, even you're doing the best thing you can. I mean, if you have a high tunnel full of tomatoes next to your field, if I was you, I wouldn't be spraying 2,4-D.
Well, one specific instance that I remember that really stands out to me, we had an entire field of alfalfa and a pretty good-sized fence row that separated the spring burn-down area, the corn to be planted in corn area, from this greenhouse that had tomatoes. It was about, I don't know, not quite half a mile spread out difference there. Almost no damage in the alfalfa, and tomatoes just smoked them.
Mm-hmm.
It on the first, you know, day or two, you saw a little bit of leaf curl, you see a little bit of tinge, and within a week, you know, the whole greenhouse is coming down. So yeah. It doesn't take much in a controlled environment like that to do a lot of damage, especially to tomatoes.
Yep.
And
yep.
I tell you too, outside of the high tunnels and greenhouses, one of the things, you know, in early COVID, you know, back, if we go back to 2020, how many people went back to raising a garden that they didn't before?
I'm one of them.
I mean, you know, you just drive around and you see a lot more gardens, you know, in people's, you know, backyards or side yards or whatever. And a lot of times they're right beside a field. Now, I don't know why it seems that those gardens always seem to be real close to the field, but you know that there's more of those too. And
yeah, I've been told that's where the best soil is right
yes.
next to the field.
I think that's where that's the thought. I think you're right. And you know, just something to think about. That just take a minute and just look around.
Yep, exactly.
You know, because those tomatoes are important to somebody too. And
absolutely,
you know, just helps to keep you out of trouble. You know.
Well, Travis, are there anything that we as producers need to be looking for as far as post applications after, you know, after we get done planting, or hopefully we get to plant here before long? But are there anything from that standpoint that folks need to be aware of?
Yeah, so for post applications, and I'm actually going to go just a little bit earlier and think about as you're planting, making sure we get the residual herbicides on. So that's, I don't care if you're in corn or soybean, because we know we're going to be short on post herbicides. So we know some of these fields, we might only get one shot of a post application. So in order to set yourself up for success on that post application, you really need to have a residual herbicide and a good, robust residual herbicide with multiple sites of action. And again, that I don't care if you're in corn or soybean, both. And we do a better job of it in corn than we do soybean. And I think we're doing a better job in soybean. But the other key is make sure, and I know it's not cheap, but make sure we're going to the full rates of those residual herbicides. Because right. a lot of times in the past, we just put on, you know, partial rates or half rates, you know, to get us going and get us into the season. But this season, you need that full rate because you may not have a chance to do a second post application. And on some of these fields, the other thing you might think about, if you have access, because, you know, it's one of those things, it's chain reaction, even residual herbicides or pre-emergence herbicides are starting to get short because people are buying them up to use them. Mm-hmm. But if you do have one of those that you can put on post-emergence and do a true overlay or a true overlapping residual. So usually we wait for our residuals to break and let the weeds get up and then spray. A true overlapping residual is whenever you just say, okay, in 14 or 21 days, I'm coming back and applying another residual no matter what. And basically you're just extending that residual and then getting yourself that much closer to canopy or whatever to make that post application. So, so that's something to think about. Again, it takes a plan, and it takes a really good plan. It also takes Mother Nature cooperating with you at that 14 to 21 day period, right? Right. So it takes all that. But the other thing, you know, when we talk about the post, making sure you know what weeds are going to be out there, you know, scouting that field so you can put together the proper mix, as we talked about before, but also spraying when those weeds are small. So glyphosate, we can get away with spraying some big weeds, right? But, you know, some of these other alternative herbicides, alternative post applications or tank mixes, we really need to make sure that we're putting them on small weeds to make sure that we're getting the appropriate, you know, on the appropriate size.
Yeah, because you may not be able to come back with glyphosate to clean up.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to have some escapes, but if you can do a pretty good job to begin with, you know, that's
– Yeah.
And you're not going to see those small ones from the pickup truck driving by the field.
No, you don't. You got to get out, scout. And, you know, my recommendation, especially, you know, and I fall back to this a lot, especially if you're dealing with Palmer or water hemp, as soon as you start seeing them emerge, start making your plan to spray, because those things are going to grow, and they're going to grow quickly. And again, you're probably going to be dodging windows of rain and wind. So as soon as you see them coming up, start planning, you know, I need to be out here in 7 to 10 days to make
and especially
sure
if you've got those pressures you know, you need to be, and I keyed on a few things that you said, you know, you got to have a plan and you need to be planning about it, you know, and so you need to really, if you've got some of those weed pressures or have had some of those in the past, you really do need to make some kind of residual plan to be able to combat those weeds for sure.
Yeah. And if you're not spraying your own and you're relying on a custom applicator, you've got to have in mind that there's other people that they're going to be spraying on too. So you may be on a list, and it may be a day or two before they get to you. And having that in your plan too, to give you a little margin for error there,
be helpful.
It would be helpful. I mean, I reverting back to my crop consultant days, you know, that was big, because everybody's needing to spray at the same time, just like everybody's needing their fertilizer spread at the same time. And, you know, it's planning that and knowing that. And so,
And I think we've been harping on that probably all the whole time we've been doing our podcast, is about having a plan, and, you know, and you may need to have a backup plan and that kind of stuff. The same thing with chemicals. You know, you may have this plan, I want to spray this, this, and this, and get down to it. Well, I can't get this, so I've got to have another plan. And you want to – that whole mode of action thing is
exactly
really important.
That's exactly what I was referring to earlier when I said we were kind of been spoiled by the glyphosate issues. We didn't have to plan. And now it's a lot more details.
Well, you got to learn how to plan again.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you really do. It's something – we all know that, and farmers all know that. But it's that muscle memory kind of thing. You know, you got to get back into, things are not the same as they used to be.
That's right.
You know, we've got to get a different frame of mind.
Absolutely. I try to tell people that all the time, that we've got to do things a little bit different than we've been doing them in the past, because if we're not, we're going to be behind the eight ball, and we may have Palmer and water hemp that's huge, and then what are you going to do then?
Get your AGR,
is that what you're saying?
You need to get your AGR 6.
Yeah, absolutely.
Educate yourself, even if you're having a custom applicator do it. Educate yourself on what options are out there.
And you got to know what weed you've got.
And know what weed you've got, and then talk to your retailer and you know, say, what do you think about this? And that way both of you's ready.
Yeah. And the other publication I would say is really handy is the mode of action chart, take action mode of action chart. So you can use that along with AGR 6, and that's really cool reference if you're just looking, say, you know, I can't get this product, but maybe I want something that's in the same side of action. You can look and see what other products are there, and then go look in AGR6 and see, okay, because just because they're same side of action doesn't always mean they control the same weeds. Right. So then you still need to go back to AGR6 and double check, okay, is it still going to control my weed or not? But that can be a real quick reference to kind of see where you're at, and also to see, you know, am I just putting on the same side of action continually? Because, you know, it's all trade name products, and, farmers have a lot more to think about than herbicides. You know, not all I think about, but my job is to think about herbicides, right? So, you know, I know what they all are, but for a farmer, he has so many other things he has to think about on his farm that memorizing what mode of action or side of action every herbicide is going to be difficult.
That's where relying on your extension agent and having a good relationship with your crop consultant, your agronomist that you work through, not only so that you can have him working on your behalf and thinking of some of those things that you don't have time to think about, but also, Vicki, you touched on something there. Knowing, having that communication with your dealer so that you'll know what he has available to him through his supply chain is going to go a long way towards helping you make those decisions.
Yeah. And I think a lot of these guys know already what they have and what they're not going to have. So if you haven't had those discussions, they need to be happening now.
Yeah,
and
I would think you would be able to find out now whether this particular retailer you're working with will be able to get a product that you may be wanting to use or not. Yeah. So
and
I would think by now.
I want to throw this in too. If you do your own application, sprayer calibration is something to think about too, and making sure that your equipment is calibrated correctly and calibrated in a way that it's going to apply those herbicides the way you need them to be.
Two other things that can be found in AGR6. One is sprayer calibration instructions. And for what we usually do, Travis, we wind things up with a timely tip that's kindly pertinent to the discussion we're having. And this week's timely tip also can be found in AGR6, and that's a sample record-keeping sheet. Our timely tip for this week is to have a functional chemical record-keeping system that works for your operation, and it has all the required information for use in your state. We know some of our state requirements are slightly different, so being able to just go out to that big box retailer on the internet and buying a record book system is great. It may not have all the information that's required in your state, but if you use the guide that's in AGR6, it does have. University of Kentucky puts out an excellent record keeping book now that I think should be used by all producers. And if you have anything to add to record keeping, we'd like to hear that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Record keeping is,
it's important.
Very important. You gotta have it. I mean, just to know what you did on your field, and you know, things happen. If you get inspected, have the KDA come look at your property, you're going to have those records on hand. And depending on the product, some of those, they want you to have records immediately. And, you know, a lot of these products, we have to hold on to those records for a while. So, keeping it, and just for your, you know, really just for your own use. Farmers are doing a lot of things throughout the summer. There's a lot. I don't remember what I did last week, right? So, you know, having those records to remember everything you did on that field is extremely important.
That's a big, big point, especially when we're looking at alternative chemistries, maybe having availability or not availability to certain things. Having that record-keeping system that shows what you used in an individual field to look back on, it far surpasses just the legal requirement of keeping records. It helps you make decisions on your farm in times of need.
And something I've learned about when using dicamber from last year, you need to write down the wind speed. Mm-hmm. You need to write down time of application. You need to write down what the weather was and the temperature, and all of those things go into that record keeping system.
That goes back to that
planning.
And
that's just covering your, you know what, but you know, that's kind of what we need to do and be able to. So when KDA comes and says, we've had a complaint, you can pull out the records and say, here's what I've got, you know.
And that's an important thing to remember, that most of our inspections now are complaint driven.
Yeah.
They don't come inspect you unless you've had a problem somewhere, and you don't hear about that problem till it's too late.
Yeah. And a lot of times if they show up and you hand them over a nice, neat record book, that you already put yourself in a better place than if you just say,
absolutely.
I've had inspectors tell me that.
Yeah.
That when that's your first offering is a complete record keeping system.
Yeah.
It takes most of the tension out of the situation. Yeah.
Scrounging on a dash is not how you're supposed to do it. You're trying to find a paper.
I say this. Travis was, he helped me with my pesticide training this year in my county. And I say this in every one of my trainings, and some of my guys, they laugh about it now because I say it all the time. But an inspector told me back when I was in the ag retail business that if a farmer has nothing as far as record keeping, then I have nothing to work with.
Yep.
If a farmer has something, then I have something to work with. Yep. I've never forgot that.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. Well, Travis, we appreciate you being here with us this week. I think we've had a good time. I think we put together some good information, too. And I really want us to revisit maybe this dicamba talk.
Absolutely.
I think a little bit closer to bean time, we need to sit down and do another show just on that. So,
Most certainly. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you being here. We want to thank Travis and, of course, thank our host for this week's information. And thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us next week when our guest will be Mr. Brent White. He is the sheriff of Lyon County, Kentucky. He is a retired state police. He's spent his whole career, professional career in law enforcement, but he farms too. He's going to be online and visit with us to talk about a little bit of road safety and what we should be doing, how much attention we should be paying with a lot of this big equipment on the road, because we do anticipate being able to plant at some point this spring. So, but we do want you to make plans to join us for our next week episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.